listening to the Andy Greenwald Podcast.
Hello, my name is Andy Greenwald. Welcome to my podcast. Today was an exciting one. I finally got to talk to the creators and now showrunners of one of the best shows on TV in 2016, and certainly one of the most underappreciated, Halt and Catch Fire, which is on AMC, and just finished a pretty spectacular third season last night. I was really excited to talk to these guys, Christopher Cantwell and Christopher Rogers, because when they took over the show this year, I think they took it in places that I didn't expect it to go. It was really a tremendous drama, but particularly because of their journey. I definitely liked the first season, but didn't love it. And then fell, like many critics, fell completely in love with the second season of the show. And watching that evolution, these guys are very young. They created the show off of a spec script, which is something we talked about. Watching the evolution of them as writers has been part of the pleasure of watching the evolution of the show itself. So we got into all manner of things. If you have not seen the season three finale of Halt and Catch Fire, do yourself a favor, go see it. And then listen to this podcast, because we talked to, I talked to the Chrises about everything that happened in last night's episode. Some of those early developmental struggles that they had getting the show off the ground and turning it into the show they wanted to be. All sorts of things. And we even got, in the end, some pretty fire takes about which Star Wars prequels you need to see. Can't recommend Halt and Catch Fire on AMC enough. It is really a rare example of a drama driven by humanity, not just by genre tropes and handguns and zombies. It is a rare throwback show that is, in a very interesting way, about the invention of the future. So I assume I've got mostly Halt heads on here today, and you're in for a treat. Obviously, I'm sitting here with two gentlemen named Christopher. I'm used to that. I usually do podcasts with a Christopher. Christopher Cantwell and Christopher Rogers, who are the creators and in season three became the co-showrunners of Halt and Catch Fire, which I believe we're going to run this the day after, so I can say last night aired its fantastic third season finale, finale.
Okay, good, yeah.
Congratulations on
that.
Thank you very much.
I should warn people up at the top, we are going to talk fully, I mean, assuming you guys are on board with it,
about... Of course. Yeah, no, that's better for us.
You've seen it.
About the finale. Hopefully, you know, about what might be to come, fingers crossed. First off, I'll just say that. Congratulations. This really was a terrific season. It was a really surprising season in a lot of ways, and I'm sure I'm not the only one who had his head spun around a little bit by the decisions you made in these last two episodes.
Yeah.
Thanks, man.
Yeah. Well,
how much of... In breaking this third season, this was your first as showrunners of the show.
Right.
How much of this was always the plan, that you wanted to do a big time jump before the season was over, and how much of it was just sort of writing your way into the season and realizing you hit this beautiful crescendo in episode 8 and maybe just time to pull the ripcord and see what happens next?
We came in, Rogers and I did a weird thing where we got renewed and we went out to Joshua Tree. We rented a house, an Airbnb thing.
Nice.
And we were out there for 3 days talking about how we'd run the show together.
First of all, making TV sounds great.
Like, yeah.
You can just, just tell your wives, my buddy
later,
and I were,
yeah, we're going out to the desert.
Ask our wives about it.
Yeah, we felt like a third season we could be a little weird about it. So we went out to the desert, talked about how we'd run the show together, and then talked about what we wanted the season to be. Mm-hmm. And we had talked a little bit about that just in terms of the technological landscape. When AMC was making its decision to renew, and we had come in and said, this is what we want to do. And Chris and I, we looked at it and we said, well, they get on the plane at the end of season two.
Right.
And there was so much character story there. We didn't want to just leave that on the table and jump 4 years at the outset. We felt like that would be too much. But there was something undeniably attractive about ending season three with WWW. That just felt so cool to us, and it felt like where everything was headed, where things were pointed to in season two and in season three. So while we were on the desert, we were like, what if we just did both? What if we have a lot of character story, they just get to California, let's see what's there, let's mine there, and know at some point we're going to jump to 1990, and we'll see if we can earn it. And we did, and we didn't know when it was going to happen. We didn't know it was going to be half and half, or... 6 and 4 or 7 and 3 or one episode that was a finale. And ultimately everything kind of built to a natural crescendo in 8. Mm-hmm. And so we said, well, let's do kind of a bridge episode with 9, and then 10 can be that reunification, which is something else we talked about in the desert a lot, everybody back together.
One of the things that I love about Halt and Catch Fire is not just the ability to use a lot of computer metaphors in discussing it, but quite literally, your show has had such it's so nimble with the idea of rebooting and what that can mean and the advantages that can offer. And I always think about your show when I'm trying to grapple with this idea of the set course of TV shows. I think for a long time there was a perception that a TV show sketches out its terrain and then drills deeper. And in many ways, there's a lot. You know, if there's a lot there in that land, that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. If not, if it's a little bit dry, you're stuck there. Mm-hmm. The two of you have never seemed to subscribe to that theory, and the show has really benefited from it. You take what you want from each place, then you move on and find more things in it. Was that freedom? Did you just? I know this was your first job in TV. Yeah. Is that something you just sort of assumed you could have and then ran with it, or did you ever run up against any walls?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was learned by necessity, you know, because I think the endeavor of writing a pilot is kind of this brinksmanship of like, what is the most story you can write and leave your character out in the desert in his underwear, you know, talking into mm-hmm. a tape recorder and then try to get him out of that corner. So I mean, I think we wrote the pilot from that place, you know, spent a while in the first season trying to figure out what the show could be. And we always kind of subscribe to that idea that you need to leave yourself, you know, in a corner with all your story told. So I actually think that's where the best stuff comes from is when you're empty and you guys have to go in and do the work. I mean, that's the juice. That's the, like, crazy exciting part of making TV. So each season we have tried to leave every single thing we had on the table. And I think in the same way that, you know, Louis C.K. has to, like, do his 20 minutes fresh every year. I think that keeps us in love with the process, and that's actually the part of it we enjoy, is putting yourself in that hole and seeing if you can find a way out.
I mean, let's actually, just for listeners who don't even know this, talk about the specifics of the creation of the show before returning to the finale. Am I correct that this was essentially the spec pilot that you guys wrote just to potentially be staffed or to work in television, right? And this is the thing where where your agents or one's agents say, put all your ideas into it to show what you want to be doing, because this is going to get you a job, and then it's going to go in a drawer.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's exactly what happened. We wrote one pilot, and that got us repped. And then they said, well, write a second one so you have two samples. And so, and they said, write something you're passionate about because we're never going to sell it. That's what they said. Mm-hmm. And so we wrote Halt based on that, kind of huddled up in my office at Disney at the time, because mm-hmm. We were both working in online media and Disney. And we wrote it, and then they read it, our agents read it, and they said, well, we like it a lot. Let's just take it to three places and see what they say first before we just expose it to staffing.
Right.
So they took it to HBO, Showtime, and AMC. And Showtime...
Just some small players, no big deal.
Yeah, and it was like, well, that's cool. And we went to Showtime and went to HBO, and they were very gracious. We got the bottle of water. We did the general meeting. Yeah.
Did you validate your parking?
They validated our parking.
Well,
yeah, the HBO had that like crazy marble, like Beowulf-type hallway entrance. I don't even know if they're still there. But, you know, and they talked to us, and they said, here's the books we have. Here are the things we're working on. What are you guys working on? Well, we wrote this pilot, nothing else. And then they said, well, cool, let us know what you write next. And that's typically how those meetings go. And we thought AMC was largely going to go that way as well. Mm-hmm. They said they may want to talk to you about some of the stuff on their slate. And it was kind of the last important meeting that we had scheduled. And so we just went in there prepared to talk about Halt and Catch Fire as long as we possibly could. Mm-hmm. And they surprised us by putting us in a conference room. We had never been put in a conference room before.
Oh, yeah, that's serious.
Yeah, you usually just go in someone's office and you sit on their couch. And so we went into a conference room, and then three executives came in, mm-hmm. and they all had copies of the script. And so that was a good sign. So
your
we ended up, of Halt.
That would have been weird if they walked in the
room. Yeah, with something
like,
else.
We really like these scripts.
We think this show is great, and it's not yours. And so we ended up talking to them for about an hour and a half, just with a bunch of sound bites we had practiced. Mm-hmm. And kind of just, this is like a good way to talk about this. This is our personal connection to it. And we just stayed in there as long as possible. And our agent wrote us that night and said, don't quote me on this, but I think I might be able to sell this to them. Mm-hmm. And so then that process was, 3 months until they bought the script?
Something like that.
How did you guys spend those 3 months? In Joshua Tree, I imagine, just tripping your balls off.
Probably working a day job. I mean, I feel like I remember taking some of the important calls, you know, like slunk really low in my car, you know, with like the window cracked so I wouldn't suffocate listening to my cell phone and trying to be like, yeah, we definitely see a future for Joe that spans six seasons.
And I had quit. I had quit the job. We had worked at the same place.
Did you quit the day that you had that meeting?
No.
Like, later, suckers.
No. I quit the weekend before my wedding, which was just a terrible idea.
Yeah.
Because my wife went on her fellowship year. She was a grad student at SE. And so all of a sudden we were just in a house.
So you knew
together.
You didn't need a fixed income. You're
yeah, we were just
student,
like, let's just sit in this apartment downtown. And so we were living in downtown LA. And so I was kind of like, I was like the man in the field. And then you were still at Disney. Mm-hmm. And we were communicating that way. But I was just like kind of a wreck.
Taking
and just
really
a mess.
Long lunches where it was like, yeah. Hey, I need to drive to Santa Monica and back. I might be a little late.
I was getting fights with like Hare Krishnas on the street, just that were too loud outside. Just everything was bothering me. But yeah. But then it was like December 7th or 8th that they called and they said, hey, we want it.
I mean, it's in a way, it's nice symmetry that it was AMC because I think AMC's arrival on the scene as a serious player in television came from taking chances on those desk drawer scripts. You know, the Matt Weiner wrote Mad Men famously to get staffed on Sopranos and to get out of Becker.
Right.
No shots at Becker, of course. You got to do what you got to do. But investing in the script that isn't supposed to be the script, you know, that was written for nothing but your own edification and your own entertainment.
In many ways, I think there's a version of us going to that AMC meeting and getting any kind of general on Mad Men that we would have been elated with. You know, I remember Chris went on his honeymoon and we were supposed to get a meeting with Jack Orman to staff on Pan Am as baby writers. And it felt like the end of the fucking world that we couldn't go to that meeting because Chris was on his honeymoon. You know, so
I was like, this was my chance. I missed it.
Yeah, like that. It was very low.
Guys, the Margot Robbie stories you would have had.
I know.
Absolutely.
A whole different two roads diverged.
No shade to Jack Orman.
No, of course. We're talking about how, you know, you had the script. You didn't think this was going to happen in the way that it did, and then it did. And, you know, I think you guys are familiar with my own journey with your show, which I can talk about here, which was I really liked and admired the first season. And then was blown away by what you discovered in the journey of that first season. You know, I think in many ways it could sound like a backhanded compliment, but I think it's almost more impressive to find the best version of the show in the show you're already making. You know, I think many people would make one show, the show that you're starting with, and then be like, okay, going back to that idea of being fixed in one place. Mm-hmm. But as that first season unfolded for people who watched it, you know, it became pretty clear what you had with Carrie Bechet and Mackenzie Davis as performers, but also in terms of the dynamic of the female characters and, you know, bringing them closer to the foreground over the course of that season and ultimately into the second season. Can you talk about that journey from the inside, basically, making a season? You've never made a TV show before. Now you're making this one. And
I think it was the journey of kind of us as writers and creators. I mean, I think you get your show on the air and you're just, oh my God, what are we going to do? You know, like how do we tell this story week in and week out? But once you settle down, you start to kind of look around and say, what's working? And the way a writer's room works, ideally, when it's functioning at its highest level, is when you hear the right idea, everybody gets really excited and it's really fun. Mm-hmm. And when you're like in the right vein, there's a lot of pitches, there's a lot of energy, there's a lot of jokes. And you have to learn to kind of trust that energy and say, like, this is where the story wants to go. This is what's working. Looking at, you know, the dailies and the episodes you're getting back and saying, these performances are really compelling. These two are really good together. I mean, Cameron and Bosworth is something that, you know, we stuck them together and we're like, whoa, what? That? More of that. And I really think the journey of the first season, which, you know, we do take the unpopular opinion that the first season was good too, was us figuring out what...
I never said it wasn't good.
Oh, no, other people do.
But, you know, was feeling where the energy wanted to go, and when it flowed kind of into this idea of mutiny and this kind of like neon, frenetic, kind of more jokey pace and this tone that kind of felt a little more like our own than us kind of aping the shows we admired, the shows that made us want to do this.
Feeling like we needed to be serious.
Yeah, I mean...
But also in a way being guests in the house of television, right?
Like, we walked into a writer's room and it was the first time we'd ever been in a writer's room. It was on our show, but everyone around the table had more experience than us. And it was Jonathan Lisko was show running at that point. Mm-hmm. He had just come off Southland. He's out of the John Wells School. He now has Animal Kingdom.
Yeah.
Zach Whedon had been on Deadwood, mm-hmm. been on Rubicon. Jason Cahill had been writing since ER.
Sopranos.
He'd been on The Sopranos. We had a playwright from Chicago, New York.
Some you might have heard of.
You know, Davi Waller had been on Mad Men. I mean, it was just, was a murderer's row of people. So we were intimidated.
Yeah.
And so we just went in saying, rule of thumb, we got to keep an open mind. When anybody talks to us, whether it's a writer, any idea, a production head, the studio, everybody, let's keep an open mind because they've been doing this longer than we have. And we got to keep this thing malleable so that we can find it.
Yeah.
And I think that served us well.
Yeah, and I think by the end of the first season, the show kind of became its own thing and stepped out of the shadow of kind of the things it was inspired by in that we've tried to listen to that, you know, because that just felt good to us too.
Well, the other thing is that it makes sense that you guys would begin to identify more with the youthful energy of Cameron's character than necessarily the, you know, Joe McMillan comes in trying to pass in a way, mm-hmm. in a much more grown-up, established world, which mm-hmm. You could maybe draw some parallels there as well.
Sure.
But realizing that the energy that you guys could relate to and that was more exciting was coming from a little bit elsewhere on the script. But again, you built adaptability into your project.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There was the possibility to do that. And the thing that really clicked for me was the realization at the end of this first season that the show wasn't really about aping the past or giving us a window into the past. It was about the struggle to invent the future, which is a very, very different thing and a very difficult thing to communicate, but mm-hmm. something that you guys really were able to steer into. So much so that there's a great line from the finale, the line that the whole world conspires to keep that from happening, basically.
Mm-hmm.
This season I found particularly moving because you realize being a visionary is rare, but not that hard. Enacting the vision
right.
is what's hard. It takes money. It takes patience. It takes a lot of personal sacrifice and pain. And that was a really remarkable sweet spot to put your show in, because that's not something that we often see expressed in, well, I was going to say in TV, but in art, really. I mean, it's a very abstract concept.
Mm-hmm.
But this is kind of, am I hitting something here? Like, this is
it's funny. And you know what else is what we like is that in the finale of this season, Cameron even calls out the fact that they've been saying the word future since too much.
It's a bribe.
Right? It's a bribe. You know, like, she's like, I'm so sick of hearing about the future. And I think that, but that's what keeps the characters going, that keeps them moving forward. And I think that gives the show, even when these people are doing incredible emotional or psychological violence to each other, an innocence and a hope that you might not find in another show that can take things super dark
mm-hmm.
and super nihilistic,
mm-hmm.
Where we're, you know, where it almost feels, it's present day, but it feels post-apocalyptic in tone, where it's just like, we're all dead. You know, like, our characters are not there yet, you know?
No.
They might be in 30, 35 years, but, you know, it's nice to stay in a time where they can...
Well, they're all Gatsbys. Like, they all believe tomorrow they will reach out their arms farther. You know, mm-hmm. tomorrow it'll work where it didn't work today. And they keep buying back in. And, I mean, I think we love people that do that despite their setbacks, personal and emotional. And, you know, I think that's what it is to... I mean, they're artists, too. That's what it is to create art, I think, is to never be content with what you've done and to always think there's a better version of it to do. And...
Well, one of the things that perplexed me at first was that you had chosen to set the show in more or less in our universe, where Steve Jobs is mm-hmm. real, where Microsoft mm-hmm. is real. These things were happening. It almost took me until this last season, almost until the finale, to really get walloped by why I think maybe you did that, which was Mutiny couldn't succeed.
Yeah.
It, you know, Mutiny isn't going to suddenly turn into America Online.
We don't use Mutiny. Yeah.
Right, that's the thing. Yeah. And I was like, are they doing an alternate universe where these guys invent the future? But it's not that. All of a sudden, there's this extra layer of melancholy and sadness baked into it where they did know. They could mm-hmm. see it, but they weren't those people. They didn't have that luck, that moment. Mm-hmm. You know, it's because it's our universe, we couldn't... They couldn't be those people,
and I think that's
idea, heartbreaking.
That idea of history is being written by the winners, you know.
Yeah.
And I think, and the technology is just one field that is littered with the failings and trials and tribulations of people who did get there first or second or better or in a different way, but had other problems or conflicts that didn't resolve in time for them to get to the place, to the precipice, and stand there next to Steve Jobs or in front of Steve Jobs. And those types of characters, you know, you could call them losers, are fascinating to us. You know, I think that word is pejorative a lot of the time, but It is such a human story.
Yeah.
For all of us, you know what I mean? And I think that, you know, it's much more complex, and it's not so black and white, you know, in terms of these people all at the same time groping around in the ether and in the dark looking for something and finding maybe half of it or all of it, but just not being able to hold on to it.
Well, also you have this divide that appears by the end of the third season, that the quote-unquote artists or visionaries of your main cast, Cameron and Joe, are right. They're constantly right,
mm-hmm.
but they mess things up and get it so wrong.
Yeah.
The workers, if I don't know what else to call them, Gordon and Donna, are one gets the sense from this finale, season finale, especially Donna, like, Donna's good. She's mm-hmm. fine.
Yeah.
She has succeeded, and you've given that character such, you know, such a depth and humanity that we feel good about, and we are aware of who she is now versus who she was before.
Mm-hmm.
But she's not great. Quote, I'm putting that in quotes. You know, mm-hmm. she won't have, there won't be magazine articles written about her. There won't be Aaron Sorkin scripted biopics written about her potentially. You never know.
Sure.
And allowing all the characters to be fully human in that way, but having that divide between what they want to accomplish and what they screw up in their own lives.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and I think the truth of all of these characters is that nobody is ever purely a visionary all the time. You know, I mean, it's,
sometimes they're assholes too.
Yeah,
frequently. Yeah. Frequently, you know, and I think it's, you know, as Chris was kind of saying, history is cliff notes written by kind of the loudest winners, you mm-hmm. know, and so we've always kind of felt like there was a story to tell in the cracks of that. You know, and so what makes somebody like Joe, who is wrong a lot of the time, who can't do a lot of the technical things Donna can do, kind of seen as one of the visionary characters on the show, is a persistence and an ability to kind of learn and evolve and change. And I think what was so satisfying about this third season is we've seen the backstory of these people that brought them to now. You know, mm-hmm. in the pilot, we're asking you to accept their backstories, mm-hmm. which you haven't got to be on the ride for. And, you know, one of the great joys of the season was seeing Donna kind of step into the fact that she might be great at this, you know,
yeah.
that maybe she should be shooting higher, that she aspires to things. So who's to say Donna couldn't work her way into visionary
yeah,
systems?
We talked.
Wait,
yeah,
let me be clear. There yeah. is, other than you guys, there is no bigger Donna fan in the universe.
This is a real generational divide, though, I find, because I have found that older fans of the show are like, that Cameron is just so annoying, and everyone's trying to get stuff done.
Oh, man, yeah.
And
my
look
parents.
At her hair.
Wait, really?
My parents' friends retired to Palm Springs,
friends.
And they're like, I hope
yeah.
Cameron figures out her hair this season. I'm like, Jesus, what?
Wow.
She looks great. You know what I mean? It's like, also, she's brilliant.
Either
she's
you identify
than you.
With, like, Cameron as, like, the upstart rebel trying to keep, you know, the soul of things, or you identify with Donna as, like, the pragmatist that's just trying to get things done while Cameron
but
is strident.
But this is, I don't think I'm expressing exactly yeah. the way I should, but one of the real pleasures of the show is that they are neither one nor the other, you know?
Right. Yes,
and,
exactly.
And
very
this comes from the writing, but I think
yeah.
it also, and maybe you could speak about this too, but it so much comes from performance as well.
Yes.
And
yes.
one of the things that I was blown away by, I mean, Mackenzie's performance throughout the series blows me away, but mm-hmm. particularly in these final two episodes after the time jump, she is a different person, but mm-hmm. she's very much the same person.
Yeah.
And she has been able to, throughout the arc that you've written for her, be the sort of naive, idealistic, antisocial, awkward punk that maybe the parents are responding to.
That's what I think it is. Yeah.
But she's also very much a young human woman, you know,
mm-hmm.
and is fully aware and fully present in that. And, you know, you didn't treat the marriage as a joke, as a one-off, which was really gratifying to see. And so when she comes back, she's, quote-unquote, comes back. I mean, you probably filmed that episode a week after the one before it. But the point being, right. she has different hair.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
But she is living or exuding the experience that has happened in the intervening 4 years, which is a pretty neat trick.
Yeah, I think, yeah. She's exceptionally talented in that way and can bring something like that to her. And they all were very interested in what happened to them in 4 years,
yeah.
you know? And I think that, because it's longer than they've actually known each other in the series
yeah.
that the time jump happens. You know, and the same is true for Carrie. I mean, you know, with Carrie, you know, even through the time jump you know, right before, something that we talk about in the writer's room and something that Chris said that stuck with me is that the one kind of Achilles heel with someone, anyone, is that you want to go back and fix the past. Where did you mess up?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's in Donna's head. And, you know, she had some antagonistic qualities this season and some adversarial qualities, but the way Carrie wrapped her head around it, which I loved, was she is just, she wants to prove that she can do this just as well as anybody else mm-hmm. in that group. And I think even by the finale, it's not, she wanted to play that schism between her and Cameron, that final schism, as not, man, I'm going to destroy you. This is revenge. It's like, no, watch this. Like, I can do this without you. Yeah. And it's really, she's really stepping off the cliff there at the end. You know, she makes that phone call and leaves the parking lot. And it's really, that's been her journey this whole time, which is I'm not going to be the person in the background. I'm going to do this.
How much were you aware of in the writing and the conception of the series of the established TV tropes that you were so wonderfully playing off of and defeating? To say that, you know, the wife on a prestige drama is the fun crusher, is the foil. Donna, the development of Donna in particular is really, I think, meaningful and wonderful to watch because she is nobody's foil, especially by the end. You know, she's not just the business brains behind Cameron anymore. She's not just Gordon's wife. She's not just Joni's mother, which is a handful. She is completely her own woman and her own protagonist on this story going forward.
Yeah, a ton. I mean, because, you know, I think we're both in our early 30s, you know, so the shows that made us want to do this are kind of those great difficult men shows that are about Tony Soprano and Don Draper and anti-heroes kind of in that mold. But, you know, if they do have a flaw, some of them, it is that the wife is an accessory to, you know, and often an obstacle to the fun that the husband is trying to have. And so we felt an opportunity and a responsibility to come in and not kind of waste the incredible talent we had, and Carrie Bechet especially. So we're thrilled to kind of be of that wave. You know, we, in casting Carrie for the part, assured her that Donna was always going to be more, and we wanted to write her as more, and hopefully we kind of kept true to that from the pilot on. That scene where she does the speak and spell is still
We seeded the fact that she's an engineer in the pilot,
and that was key in that pilot. I mean, I feel like that's a scene that maybe could have been noted out of it or something, but
totally. I mean, that's what's cool about making TV right now, is that it really does feel like you can try to like explode the things that have come before. You really need to use every character you have. You know, it's very hard to write from a place of a moral or a position that you take on representation, but at the same time, if you just treat all your characters like real people with valid opinions, then it's hard to mess up.
And I think in order to explode those archetypes, we had to start with them a little bit. You know, like we
sure.
And I think that the performances of the actors really informed that. You know, I think that Lee coming in as Joe, he brought a fragility and a humanity that was kind of simmering underneath the surface. It wasn't just the normal cipher, like, what's going on with this guy? I think what we responded to and what we tried to write to was that there was a lot more, and that he was wearing that suit and he was donning this persona because underneath was something that I think we see much more of in season three, which is this, he's pretty strange. You know, he's like a pretty eccentric guy that's just, he's on a different level and doesn't really know how to connect. I think that's really important. Same thing is true with John Bosworth. You know, Toby Huss brought something to that character that was completely different. And then you look at Scoot McNairy, where it's like, oh, you think this guy's going to get out of the cubicle and he's going to live at large. He's going to get to the top. But there's something going on completely different with Gordon, you know, and I don't think Gordon's even figured it out yet.
I got to say, I think my favorite, Lee Pace in the two-part finale is my favorite Joe that we've seen.
Oh, yeah.
Good.
That's awesome.
He,
yeah.
Especially in the first part when he goes to Comdex, and there's a brightness and a freedom to him there. And, of course, that's the context. You know, he's undercover. He's there for one reason and one reason alone. But his performance really clicked for me in a remarkable way in that scene because, as you're saying, we are seeing a person that has been there but buried beneath a number of different, number of different layers.
Yeah.
Specifically that idea of them being archetypes early on, you guys are aware of the criticism in the shorthand early on where people were like, oh, well, it's Don Draper and Walter White in the garage, basically. These are types that we've seen before.
Sure.
It did not end up that way whatsoever. But what was it like internally within the show as you began to change the balance on the playing field where Lee and Scoot were doing one thing in the foreground, and then especially in the second season, it sort of shifted. They were more in the background of the primary plot. What was that like working your actors through that? Because, you know, you sign on to a show, you don't know what the show is going to be. Mm-hmm. It could be a 2-year journey, a 7-year journey. How were they with those changes?
I think people, the perception is that was more of a conscious shift than it was. You know, I think we just tried to continue to write what we felt were compelling and earned stories for each of those characters based on where we left them in season one, and it ended up portioning out a little more towards Mutiny. I mean, we got tremendous credit in the press for rebalancing the show or rebooting the show around the women, but I don't think we ever sat down and said, this is what we have to do.
Right.
I think, again, it kind of speaks to like the fun and energy we're having. You know, Lee, I'm thrilled he's kind of getting the credit he deserves this year, because I think his performance has always been under the most scrutiny. He's a leading man. He's got, you know, those chops and that jaw, and he's the guy who was on the poster that everyone knew at the beginning mm-hmm. of the show. But I think he's turned in a very kind of subtly brilliant evolution for this guy, culminating in kind of the finale we'll have seen last night if we're using Future Talk.
Yeah.
So, you know, we didn't have to kind of sit anyone down and kind of work through their feelings on page count, because I think everyone just kind of bought into the idea. And as long as the scripts are good and you're mm-hmm. open and, you know, we luckily don't have those actors that call you up and say, you know, where's my big scene? When do I cry?
Or if they do, you just send them to the other Chris.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. You want Chris Rogers. Yeah. He's extension. I think like there were a few key things that the actors brought to the characters that we, that spoke to us. That I think we wanted, you know, no matter how much we changed their stories, we wanted to remain true to. I think early on in season one, Lee said something that I loved, which was that Joe is a zealot. He believes in this stuff. He loves it. It drives him. He's not a snake oil salesman.
Mm-hmm.
He's not a liar. I mean, he'll lie to get what he wants, but it's a means to an end.
Right.
He believes he knows what's better for everyone else, even if they disagree. And that became, I feel like, a central tenet of writing that character, even in season two, where he's really kind of down in the dumps for a while and really clawing his way back and, you know, trying to be a human being in this mm-hmm. kind of conscious way. You know, Scoot, you know, talked to me a lot about, and Chris a lot about, you know, the fact that he wants to provide for his family, that he is an unlikely father figure, that he sees Gordon in this way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we were able to really exploit that in season three with first the mutiny coders and, mm-hmm. and then the way he connects with other people.
The way he connects with Cameron.
And I think that he's a guy that, and then also for me, you know, he has the most trouble maintaining his connections.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's literally in one episode in season three, like the plug keeps falling out from his ham radio and he's got to tape it there.
He's in the closet trying to talk to anybody.
And he just, the plug keeps falling out. Like he cannot. And then in season two, we said, you're going to spend this season entirely disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily we've got an actor in Scoot McNairy where he can pull something like that off.
Mm-hmm. His performance is really
it's amazing.
I think it's in many ways it flies under the radar because he's willing to go to places that are unpleasant.
Yes.
Physically, verbally. He doesn't make it easy to watch Gordon when he's having his medical issues, when he's saying things, intemperate things, let's say, or he's behaving in ways that he shouldn't. He is 1,000% committed.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've appreciated that more even on rewatching it. I mean, I obviously know he's a strong actor, but you see the work that he's doing. It is not a showy performance. It's just a fully present performance.
And he invites that. I mean, I remember him saying, so we sit down with each of the actors before the season starts. We have them come into the writer's room and, if necessary, kind of meet new writers. Our season three staff was entirely new.
That's when you hold their hands.
That is when we hold their hands. But you know, we have them tell us, you know, what do you think about the character? You know, what do you think the character thinks about this? You know, and we really kind of try to gauge where they are, because they all, you know, they all live it. They all own these characters. They have an ownership and they have a voice in what happens to them that matters to us. And I remember going into the second season, him saying, load Gordon up with problems because Gordon can handle it. And I want to, you know, I want to be Gordon and kind of do those things. And I think that's so true about Scoot. So, you know, Gordon, the universe is not kind to frequently. There's a lot of like, oh, Gordon. But I just think he shines in those moments. And I think there's like kind of a beauty in the way he struggles. And you know, so much of that is Scoot and who he thinks that character is and who he's allowed us to make that character.
I think my favorite moment of the season was in the second to last episode, and it's at Comdex when there is an impromptu dance party to the Pixies song, Gloria.
Yeah.
The music, by the way, throughout, that we could do a whole podcast on that. It's tremendous.
Killer.
But that scene, you know, there's just a deep humanity and joy in that moment that the characters are experiencing, and that as a viewer I was experiencing as well. And it made me think about something that I've often reflected on in watching your show, which is, all you have really to play with, I mean, we have computer metaphors and I enjoy those, but all you have is the humanity of these characters.
Yes.
You do not have guns to fall back on. You do not have genre tropes to fall back on. Mm-hmm. You cannot ratchet up the stakes by having, you know, a dragon fly in. Mm-hmm. I imagine that makes it more rewarding, but also enormously more challenging. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. I think that it's, but that's, I think there's a joy in that challenge for us.
Yeah.
I mean, I think in that scene you're talking about,
directed by Chris Cantwell.
I had the privilege of directing that scene. Yeah. I think one reason why that scene is so much fun is because we made, I think, Mackenzie and Lee do it 7 or 8 times. So they're exhausted and like a little pissed off at me, you know, like just like, yeah, let's do it again. So they're just sweaty, but it, like, it, that's what helps with the energy. And, you know, it's really the humanity of the characters, and it's the stable of actors. It's like we know we have the luxury of knowing that we can write anything for these five,
mm-hmm.
And then some of our guest stars that come in and they can do it, they can pull it off. And for us, that moment of the big goal for Joe this season was to make him a human being. Let's finally get him there. Mm-hmm. Let's make him a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And we really put him through some tough stuff with Ryan, you know, this season, and have him be kind of at the top but dim inside and then reignited. And we talked about this in the writer's room, that Joe becomes dangerous when his passion is reignited, because mm-hmm. he is that zealot. And he does play a fast and loose game, and we do see a real casualty of that. And we wanted that for him to finally take him to that place of, I think that is 2 seasons long for probably both him and Gordon. Starting at the beginning of season 2, where they're both kind of in these torture boxes, you know, almost being punished for their hubris of season 1, that they crawl themselves, they crawl out of the basement into their lives and discover something new about themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that you see new people in episode 9.
Well, and I think to your question about the guns of it all too, I mean, when we allow ourselves to be proud about things, we're incredibly proud about the fact that there are no guns in the show, and that characters have to convince other characters to do other things with, you know, their wits and their words. It seems like an obstacle that you can't just manufacture drama out of the circumstance changing dramatically in somebody's life being at risk, but it's actually, I think, a huge gift to us, because it keeps us very honest and makes us double down on a character every time. And I'm grateful for that, not only because it's, I think, a statement we want to make about art, that art doesn't need to just be the chronicling of violent events by violent people, but...
And nor does television, although it's increasingly is that.
Yeah, but, you know, I think it makes us better writers, you know, I mean, I think...
Well, it leads to scenes like the mutiny breakup scene in the conference room, which is, you know, it's a high point of TV for the year for me. And,
oh, thank you very much.
But you can't make that scene without the 6 episodes that preceded it, right? I mean, you have to do the slow build. We should do a couple plot points before I let you go. You broke up Gordon and Donna.
Yes. We did.
That's a tough one.
Yeah,
that is a tough one.
Can you tell me about the thinking behind it? And also, well, I'll leave it at that. I mean, we clearly saw cracks in the relationship. So it was not a surprise.
Right.
But it was a surprise that you yada-yada'd us right into it.
Yeah, and I think that the yada-yada of it was the fun part. And I think we did that with Mutiny, too. We kind of yada-yada'd Mutiny out of existence in this kind of slow atrophy, to use Chris's words.
The time gap could have been the 4th season. And I wondered it for a minute when I was watching it, whether you know, we hadn't heard any news because you were ending the show and you just basically did your 4th season in 2 episodes. Which, by the way, kudos. That was impressive.
I mean, hey, you know, we could do that. For us, you know, we talk about that there's a binary quality to some storytelling elements that you can fall into. Gordon and Donna are mad at each other. Gordon and Donna are doing great. Cameron and Donna are mad at each other. Cameron and Donna are doing great. How can you evolve those relationships? And the divorce didn't feel like a shutting down of Gordon and Donna. It felt like now we can take them somewhere completely different. Mm-hmm. And I think that just by feeling that, then I think there's a couple scenes, you know, in 9 and in 10 between the two of them where the dynamic is now different. Yeah. And
but it's
complicated.
Tempting to slip back.
Yes, and it's tempting to slip back, and it was something that we also wanted to avoid in the finale. We didn't want them to just fall right back to each other. But but now they're in a completely different part of their life, and it's super complicated between two people who can be amicably divorced,
yeah,
and yet have all of this history personally, professionally, what does that do to them now? So now it feels, it opened up a new road for us.
How was the experience? You've had a pretty unique journey. You created the show, were paired with Jonathan Liskow, who's a more experienced showrunner who worked with you guys for two seasons before going off to Animal Kingdom. You then were able to take over the show as showrunners yourself in year three. How was the transition? You know, as a viewer, it was seamless. You know, everything that was good about season two, I think, was even improved upon in season three. What lessons did you learn from that sort of odd apprenticeship into what you turned into this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of there's this quote Bill Gates and Ballmer give about when Microsoft was kind of indebted to IBM when they were doing an operating system for them, where they say they were just trying to ride the bear. You know, they were just trying to like stay on that thing for as long as possible until it turned around and ate them. And I think when we started this process, we were just trying to like stay on the show. You know, we wrote it. It's not uncommon that a network will buy a show and kind of hand it to a more experienced showrunner and say, hey, it was nice to meet you guys, you know, look forward to those checks. So we just wanted to stay on this show from the beginning, and we had the great fortune to be paired with John Liskow, who, again, is this veteran showrunner, kind of coming out of the John Wells School, and we run his offense. I mean, writers' rooms are so often, people don't know this, kind of these abusive, scary places to work, and that, you know, everybody's very vulnerable in pitching ideas. But John Liskow's thing is, we're going to spend all of our time in the room. We are going to listen to every idea. We are going to make everybody feel heard, and we are going to be good people while we do it. And if we hadn't got to watch that for a year, I'd say participated even more in the second year, you know, make all those decisions kind of as a triumvirate, I don't think we'd have been ready to do this in a third year. Mm-hmm. So while it was thrilling to, you know, be able to get it exactly how we wanted it in the third year, kind of close that feedback loop so that it was just us, kind of our mind meld, we owe a huge debt to that guy, and you know, it was really like a masterclass in how to do this. So each year has been, I think, a little more creatively fulfilling in terms of getting to make the specifics exactly to order. Mm-hmm. But you know, it's been a hell of a ride, and I think that bear would have eaten us a lot earlier if John Liskow hadn't been there to protect us.
Much like with season two, season three ends in a place that could be a series finale. I hope that it's not, but it could be. As of now being next week, but officially on the record as of now, you don't know about a renewal. You're hoping for a renewal. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's where we always are. I mean, I think it's people really like the show. Very few people watch it, and yes, there is the rub, you know. And so the network kind of takes that into consideration, and thus far has been very supportive. But we write the ends of all of our seasons like they could end the story, not just because of the situation that our show is uniquely in, but just because it's satisfying for me as a TV viewer to have a finale that gives you a kind of catharsis with some threads of like, well, you could go somewhere there. Mm-hmm. You could, in it, where it doesn't just feel like an epilogue or a just a straight cliffhanger where you're like, well, I'll never know what happened to X character.
Yeah. Until 26 years from now when Showtime reboots it or whatever.
Right, exactly. When Dale Cooper emerges from the Black Lodge.
You know, I threw that out there and I hoped it would get...
Dude, you got the right guy. I mean, okay. My son is named after Dale Cooper. My son is Cooper Cantwell. So.
Wow, okay. Yes. When we do the Twin Peaks pod, you're coming back for that.
I'm coming back, yes.
Yeah, but I do wonder how it feels to have your show be, in many ways, a poster child for this new TV economy. And I use the show as an example a lot when I'm talking about it, which is, as you alluded to, the ratings are not robust. They're not great. But AMC, you know, has ownership in the show, believes in the show, and believes that what the show does offer, which is tremendous quality and creativity and performances, has value, and critical buzz now as well. Mm-hmm. That has value. How you monetize that value, and, you know, that's not your concern, thankfully. But it does seem to be a situation where hopefully it continues, where AMC is saying, this has value to let these people tell the story because it will continue to find a new audience. So in a way, they're programming for the future. Not unlike, I won't do it, but I did walk into it.
Well played.
Do you have to spend any time thinking about that odd sort of predicament, or is it just,
it's weird.
It's above your pay grade?
It's a gift not to have to all that much. I mean, I think we've learned in the name of sanity to manage the parts of it we can control, which is the quality of the writing, and out from that springs the quality of the show. But I think we're very lucky to exist in this era where there, kind of are no longer those big consensus hits like The Sopranos. Yeah. There was a moment when everybody was turning on their TV on Sunday night to see what happened live. And that moment is largely over for shows that aren't The Walking Dead or Game of Thrones, where characters could be killed off and you could have that spoiled for you. Mm-hmm. So I think you're going to see it all the networks right now, especially the kind of ad-supported networks, that live viewership is drastically down on every show they have, which makes the plus threes or plus sevens, as they call like the DVRs, all that much more important in terms of, and then the streaming stuff too. You know, it gives you a soundbite that you can use in moments like this. What that actually means for your creative process is that you just say thank you and keep going back to your network and saying, we'll keep trying to make it good. We're sorry. Yeah. You know,
it reminds me, it reminds me of, my dad is going to love that I bring this up, but it reminds me of the tech bubble in 99. My dad was put your money in mutual funds. You're going to make 12% a year. Why would you put your money in a checking account or savings account, make a 0.5%, 1%? You're going to make 12% a year for the rest of your life on your money in a mutual fund. Now, I asked my dad about this the other day, and he was like, you just want to stay ahead of inflation. You just want to say, your money will be worth the same, just stay ahead of inflation. That's all you want. And I feel like television, similar situation, where it's like, show profitable? Yeah. You know, it's almost like the George Bailey savings and loan, where it's like, $1, may you go forth and multiply, and they put it in the bank. So I feel like if we stay profitable, you know, which is not up to us, like it's up to, you know, the gurus over there at the network. They can work those numbers, and you know, we're doing our job creatively. So that's where we got to leave it.
And then finally, before I let you guys go, I need to get your official opinion on this, because as you may know, especially on Twitter, I have gotten very, very involved in a number of situations trying to get people to watch your show. I need to know from the creators of Halt and Catch Fire, please, you know, honestly as you can, do you have to watch the first season? What does that even mean?
This is the thing. I don't know, man.
We cannot be objective about this, because we have to love all of our children.
But do you understand why? But the reason I'm saying it is because I do feel like completism is killing fan engagement on some level.
Yeah,
and
you're
so
right.
People look
you're
at it and they're like, well, there's 30 hours of it.
And these reviews that come out, you know, that are a little bit more stringent with season one, you know, they're tough, because like it's a great glowing review of season two, season three, but nested inside there.
Always, yeah.
And it's like, and imagine, we talked about peak TV, and there's so much TV right now. Right, and you can watch anything.
Mm-hmm.
I could watch. I mean, I'm working my way through the Rockford Files. Like, we're up against season three of Cheers. Like, we're up like everything.
Yeah.
And so, if someone comes to you, and you're at a restaurant, and they say, "Boy, the New York Strip we have is incredible,"
mm-hmm.
and we got this incredible asparagus that we did with that we cooked. It just gets glazed. It's delicious as well. The baked potato tastes like shit. For half of it. Are you going to order that? You know what I mean? When the menu is literally infinitely long. Like, it's literally infinitely long.
Right.
And so I feel like
there's also sushi at the restaurant and Korean barbecue.
You can go across the street to the and that's a more of a bar place. It's owned by the same guy, but they got the same menu, but just more of the appetizers.
And it'll get you drunk, but you'll feel bad in the morning.
Yeah, exactly.
There's dragon steak. There's zombie sirloin.
There's so many things.
And then there's the broadcast network. Yeah. Speakeasy.
So I just like, do you have to watch season one? Look, live your own life. Do what you want to do.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like,
chase your
bliss. Do what you want to do, man. Like, watch it out of order. Well, you know, like, watch it on your phone.
Maybe there's like a Star Wars weird order.
Oh, yeah, like a machete order.
I actually think that's possible.
I think that is, too, now that you mentioned
because
it.
You talked about how you had the backstory that you had to trust, you know, built into the first season. My point is only I want more people to watch Halt and Catch Fire, and I want them to immediately love it. And when the question is, do I need to?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, exactly what you said.
Yeah.
You don't need to do anything. Like, it's television. It's not homework. And if you feel like it's homework, you are not going to enjoy the experience.
Yes.
If you start with season two, love it, as you should, of course you will go back and watch season one, because it's more time with your friends.
Yeah. It's kind of like the machete order. It's like you watch New Hope, Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
Then you do Attack of the Clones.
No,
I don't know.
Just
look at me like
the
I
Sith,
know.
And then you do
It's a bad
Jedi.
Analogy, because you just don't, I think.
What?
You just don't do Attack of the Clones.
Yeah, you just don't do Attack of the Clones?
Yeah, you just.
Well, I thought it was you drop Phantom Menace. The machete order is you drop Phantom, like you pretend Phantom Menace never happened.
I'm fine with that.
You do two and three. You do two and three, and then you do Return of the Jedi.
It is, but to your other point, it is unfair. The season one of Halt and Catch Fire is like, not a bad TV show.
There are other things out there that I feel like, you know, we didn't kill anybody.
It is easy to make a review oppositional, having done it. You want to say this is good because it was, and you want to suggest growth and whatever. Also, because even when writing it, you want to show people that you were paying attention, you want to have a narrative to your own piece.
Yeah. Yes. I think you could you're not
wrong in that the show's maturation, I think, in terms of its the critical response, has had a lot to do with our maturation. And I will acknowledge that there's a period in the first season where I think we are trying to figure out what the show is.
Yeah, what the hell
really
we're
trying
doing.
To land the tone. And that is concentrated at the front end of the first season. And I think people do show up, feel that, and some of them leave. And that is a shame. So, I mean, you're not wrong.
In general, embarking on a TV show is getting in a car with someone and you don't know who the driver is and you don't know where you're going. And if you, you know, with something, if you trust the person, if it's a driver you've met with, you've driven with before, you'll relax a little bit.
Yes.
If it's based on pre-existing material, you can relax because you know where it's going a little bit down the road.
Right.
It's a journey. And I think I would say this too for people. I'm assuming everyone listening right now has watched your show all the seasons. But even if they weren't, I would recommend watching all of the seasons of Halt and Catch Fire as
Andy,
a TV fan.
This means a lot.
No, but I mean it though. But as a TV fan, to literally see what we're talking about, to see people experimenting with the medium, struggling with the medium, taking advantage of the medium, learning from it.
Yeah.
I mean, part of the reason why I like TV in general is that fluidity and that learning curve and the fact that you can do repairs on the sports car while it's racing around the track.
Yeah, I think that's. I mean that is true. I mean you can actually watch an evolution. I think with our show, and I think for me when it clicks. And I remembered this in the edit room. Like, for me, when it clicks is literally at the halfway point in season one. It's when Joe takes a sledgehammer to a car and goes insane on a car at a company barbecue. Mm-hmm. And he shares an electric look with Cameron. And we had this great Steve Miller needle drop. Mm-hmm. And from I was like, wait a minute. That's the show. Like, and I think then you kind of try to reel that thing in. And then you get it and you build upon it. But I think that you see us try to get there, and it takes a couple episodes.
So to sum up, you have to watch *Halt and Catch Fire*. You don't have to watch *The Phantom Menace*.
Yeah, and you don't have to watch *The Phantom Menace*.
It's a pretty hot take.
You don't have to understand the name of the show.
Yeah,
it is not part of the *Hunger Games* trilogy. But if you can plug this into Netflix, if you can find it and catch up, we promise you won't be sorry.
Christopher's. Yeah. Cantwell and Rogers, like the attorneys general.
I like that. Yeah, that's good.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.